Got it.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode number 74 of Confessions of a Market Maker. I'm your co-host, Ray, a.k.a. All Day Ray, a.k.a. the Low Float Goat. And I'm joined here by my chic co-host, former market maker of 20 years and current day retail trader, a man who's ran an innumerable amount of penny stock deals from Canadian mining, sponges that produce their own soap, and Halloween costumes for your dog. A life he now repents for as he dries his tears with his Versace towels. The man with more stories than Forrest Gump, the proper villain, JJ. How's it going?
Good, brother. How are you today? That was wow, man. Your wind up was good on that one. That was
thank
nice.
You. Thank you. Thank you. I felt good with that one. I'm glad.
That was beautiful. Beautiful.
I felt good about that one. Yeah.
That was like Reverend Al Sharpton there. That was beautiful.
Well, you know, we're 74 episodes in. Hopefully I'm getting, I'm getting the flow down, getting the delivery. And today, our guest today, he's been working within the financial markets for over a decade. He's held various roles across equities, FX, and commodities markets, and he most recently worked as a quantitative analyst for a major sell-side bank, host of an educational and entertaining YouTube channel. I am talking about Sergey P. Sergey, I know I asked you for your name. I felt like I was going to butcher it.
Perfilia. Not a chance.
Sergey, man, I really appreciate you coming on, man. How's it going?
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here and great to be on this podcast and talking to you guys. It's going well. It's almost the end of the day in the local time zone.
Yeah.
How are you guys?
Doing great, man. Where are you at? Where are you at right now?
I'm in London.
Nice. Oh, you're in London. Sunny.
Oh, yes. Nice.
So we are 5 hours ahead.
Yeah. 5 hours.
It's almost time to get that nice end of day drink.
Yeah. There you go. And man, really glad you got on. You know, like I mentioned, like Steve reached out to you. And then I was really enjoying watching your YouTube channels, reading over some of your Twitter threads, been gaining a lot of traction. And, anything we talk about, you guys, go check out his stuff. There's a lot more detail than maybe we might be able to touch on a podcast. But the people who are watching on YouTube, man, you got the ticker channel behind you, something you see on CNBC or, some financial media. Tell us a little bit about it, man. Where do I get one of these?
Yeah, that's actually one of the frequently asked questions. I get a lot of responses of people in YouTube comments and on Twitter just asking, hey, man, where did you buy this? I want one of those. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to get one of those sort of for home use, because usually companies that produce them, they make them for offices and sort of, big spaces, and they're very expensive. So I basically was forced to do one myself. And you can buy cheaply the sort of the LED panels, which can be very easily connected together and connected to the Raspberry Pi, sort of a small personal computer, which is also not very expensive. It's like $40 or so. And then there's code on the internet, that's Python code, which you can put together, which drives this LED panel. And then you can download the data from Yahoo Finance, and that's basically the end product.
Yeah. Well, shout out to you, man. That's a great setup you got. It looks perfect for the videos too. It's a great
thank
setup
you, you
got going on there,
it's
man.
It's nice. Yeah. It's nice when we have an update, because then it's all green and it looks really good on the videos. When it's red, it's really not nice. And the thing is, it completely destroys the editing process, because if you screw up during the video and you have to edit, then the whole prices, all of them jump. And if it was a green stock and then it jumps to red stock, it's very noticeable.
Oh man, it messes up, but it's I think the aesthetic quality of it is worth it. Just a reminder to the listeners, if you guys would like to join JJ and myself in a supportive community of traders, join us at microefutures.com. Sergey, yeah, so I just want to start off the conversation with the beginnings and what led you into a career in finance.
Oh, that's a good question. So it's a good question, because I studied electrical engineering in university, which is completely non-financial. And for some reason, everyone in my entire group and the year above, year below, everyone wanted to get into finance, which completely was like, I didn't know about financial world before that. Like I came before university, I was in Ukraine, and finance is not really a big thing in sort of Russia or Ukraine, Eastern Europe. So I never found out anything about it. And then I started studying electrical engineering, and everyone's talking about finance, how they all want to go work in big banks. And it sort of caught on to me. I thought, okay, maybe I'll, you know, give it a try as well. Why is it so popular? And basically that's how it started. I had an internship in sales and trading during between my third and fourth year. That was 2008, the glory days of the financial crisis. And that's essentially how it started. It was really interesting. I guess the biggest criteria is that once you start learning about it, there's so much, and it's, again, you start exploring. And even in university, I had a few financial classes as well, where they talked about, among other things, options. And I thought that thing is really cool. And I started, again, exploring a bit more and trying to get into the career within financial markets.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So where did you go to college at? Where did you study?
So that was in London. So that's when I moved from Ukraine, from Russia to London. So that was in 2005. And I've basically been here since then.
And you've been since then. Okay. Awesome. And, for the listeners, because I know you describe yourself as a quant, or at least that was like the last job title you held. Mm-hmm. Just for the listeners, could you explain the difference between a quant, a trader, and an analyst?
Of course. I mean, a quant in general is a very broad term. Like it can really mean anything. But it's usually at the most basic level, it's the combination of somebody whose job is a combination of mathematics, software development, and trading. So it's people who try to apply mathematical side of things, so things like statistic, probability theory, implement whatever strategies they have or whatever models in computer code, and solve various financial problems within financial markets. So these problems could be either, like, again, portfolio optimization or pricing of complex products, or again, creating trading strategies for profit. So a lot of different things. Whereas again, an analyst is also a very broad term, which is usually referred to a research analyst whose job is primarily to look at fundamentals of a company and maybe create some spreadsheets, create some models based on that. So it's less mathematical, less, certainly less engineering programming.
Yeah. So how did you your first job title? Did you start off as a quant? How did it progress? I'm just kind of curious to how the progression went.
It's a bit of a story. So back in the day, when I finished university, I really wanted to go into sales. So within finance, usually people go to either trading or sales, and for some reason, I found sales to be the most attractive. It's where you're this guy, you talk to clients, you take them out for dinners, you entertain them. So that's how I saw the sale, but that's what I think the sales people do.
JJ knows about that. Yeah.
And my first sort of permanent role after a couple of internships, my first role was within Bloomberg. So I joined Bloomberg, and they have this pipeline of people if they want to go into sales. They need to learn about markets, about the terminal, and they start off on the Bloomberg help desk. So that was my sort of first permanent role. I was the person on the other side of the Bloomberg help desk chat. And I answered questions about like equity derivatives markets. And while doing that, I've kind of realized that I don't really want to do sales. because that job was, first of all, a huge exposure to clients. Like you speak to, again, buy side, sell side, everyone. If you specialize in a certain area, then salespeople will take you on meetings to sort of assist them with various clients' questions and so on. And then you obviously have to talk to them on the phone a lot day to day. So I thought I'm more interested in the technical side of things. And I found out about this quantitative analyst role, and I thought, wow, that's actually very interesting to do. It's like a combination of all these different things, which are really exciting. Again, there is maths, there is programming. I did a bit of that in university. And obviously there's finance. Amazing. And I thought, okay, so how do I get there? Because obviously back then I couldn't program. Like I had a bit of background, but I didn't know anything about, I didn't know Python or any other software development languages. And I certainly didn't know mathematical finance. So like the Black-Scholes theory, no. Like I've heard about it, but I knew only the business finance side of things. So that was back in 2014. And I made a decision to do two things. So first one, within Bloomberg, I've changed careers and I've moved into their engineering department where I worked as a software developer. And at the same time, I started a part-time degree within mathematical finance. So that took about maybe 2-3 years to complete. Mm-hmm. And by the end of that, I knew how to program. I knew very well about the Black-Scholes framework, about the mathematical finance, different topics within mathematical finance. And I started applying for quant jobs. And eventually, it's again a very long process, but eventually I've got an offer from Goldman to join them. And the last 4 years I've been on the equity structured products desk.
Nice. Can I just jump in? Because you just talked about, you know, getting recruited by Goldman. So I'm an old guy and we're used to the Goldman interview process stories. Is that still true? Or can you say, what can you say before the guy shows up and pokes you on the shoulder?
I haven't tested the limits yet.
Okay.
But I mean, I can certainly say that it's still true. It's just that I'm laughing because you've mentioned that you've been recruited by Goldman. And again, if you look at my, I don't know, LinkedIn profile, it's, you know, it's a logical progression. Like the guy was a software developer, then boom, Goldman Sachs. Okay, fine. It all makes sense. But what's not visible behind the scenes is the actual process.
Yeah, exactly.
Which has been incredibly difficult because I started applying for jobs and I thought that, okay, I've got everything I need. I've got the mathematical skills, the software development skills, you know, should be okay. Like I'm ready to go. And I haven't heard back from many banks. Wow. So it's been like a complete silence. And I started applying in 2016. And again, it's been like half a year and pretty much nothing. There's been a few interviews, mostly phone interviews, but again, nothing. It's been very difficult to get into. One of the biggest mistakes is that I didn't want to use headhunters. For some reason, I thought that I can do it on my own. Like applications, I can do an application, I can write a CV. Like I don't need this third party person, which is a huge mistake, I think, right now, because they are there to help. They know everyone within the company. But anyways, what I started doing then is I started sort of taking the bar a little bit lower and I started applying for graduate programs. And eventually the way I moved into Goldman was I got an offer for an internship, which I accepted and I started working there. The internship was for 4 months initially, which due to various reasons of me wanting to move into equity derivatives desk and a few other internal issues within Goldman, the internship lasted for 10 months instead.
Okay.
But in the end, I did get a full-time offer within the equity derivatives desk.
Okay.
But it's been a very long process, so to speak. And obviously the internship, I had to take like a pay cut from my previous role, and it's been quite of a journey.
I can imagine. How did you like your experience at Goldman? Just because I come from the world, you know, where I did completely everything the opposite of what you're supposed to do. I crawled through the sewers of the penny stock market, mm-hmm. And worked my way up, you know, to trading NASDAQ deals and things like that. But so I've always been curious about the corporate culture at Goldman. What was it like working there? You know, you read stories about Sidney Weinberg, you know, and he started there as a janitor and worked him his way up to the CEO. And just tell us a little bit for the people who always like to look inside the belly of the beast. What that culture was like, if you don't mind.
It's certainly a good question. And in general, working there is very stressful. Like it's a very demanding job, very demanding environment. Mm-hmm. But I guess if I had sort of one word to describe it, it probably would be very competitive, which is a little bit strange, especially coming sort of from, like, I mean, I only have one other company to compare it to. Yes. And my previous experiences was teams together. They work, like you really work together within the different departments, mm-hmm. within different teams. But in Goldman, there's a very high internal competition.
Okay.
Which I found a little bit strange because again, we're sort of one company, we work together, we work for the same goal. But usually people on different desks, the idea is that if you spend time helping another desk, you're not spending time working on your own projects. Yeah. Hence, you're not, you know, helping your own desk. You're not helping your own department, business unit.
Exactly.
So it's always a challenge to get some help from different desks when, you know, the project requires you to work with different teams. So I guess that's one side of the things.
That's interesting. I guess Well, I guess everyone's trying to make partner, right? So there.
And that too. And then, yeah, then there's a, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you. Thank you.
And people, yeah, people work really hard in Goldman. Like it's an absolutely incredible. It's really like, I think Goldman is an excellent place. And in general, like probably sell side banks, it's an excellent place for people who just graduated from university. Like the first couple of years, it's the learning curve is really steep. You learn a lot, meet a lot of people. It's really great. When you get older, I think it's, I mean, you get such other priorities in life. And again, in my case, for example, I don't mind working like hard and, you know, really putting your effort into it. But then again, when you have other priorities, like you have family and other things going on, it becomes more and more difficult to sort of put in long hours.
Understood. Understood.
Interesting. I want to, I really like that, you know, I mentioned some of like the Twitter threads, and I really like the, you know, the pin tweet that you have. It's on the non-glamorous things that you should know as working as a sell side quant. And, you know, then after we go through this, I want to ask you the differences between a sell side quant and a buy side quant, if there is differences. I think it was like the first, I think it was like the first thing you noted was, so the primary responsibility of a quant is to help traders calculate prices and risks of their books correctly. Modeling or developing comes second.
Correct, yes.
I found that very interesting. You want to just like speak to that?
Sure. So there is this term, KTLO, keeping the lights on, which is very popular within this sort of the software development world. So companies, again, big companies like including Goldman, but Facebook, Google, there is a lot of work that involves just keeping things running. So just making sure that the current systems are functioning correctly and everything's working correctly. So that is the main priority. So if the current system goes down, if the current risks are wrong, for example, for the trader, or the sales is trying to price a complicated deal and it doesn't work, or there's an error, like that's the priority number one, because the business depends on that. Like if they can't get the deal out of the door, then well, what are we doing? So anything extra, like anything, for example, developing, creating new models, creating new tools, for example, that can hold if there is a burning issue that needs to be resolved like right now. So that's basically what is meant by that tweet. In terms of workflow, it means that if you're working whatever project and something urgent comes up, I mean, you drop everything and you address that whatever risk issue or P&L issue, whatever it might be.
Okay. Now, so cause like I always imagined like your day, and you could tell me like maybe what like a typical day, and I'm sure it obviously varies, you know, but, I would imagine you just be there like you're modeling different strategies, you're back testing, et cetera. Like, you know, but it seemed like as the thread was going on, that was almost, I don't want to say secondhand, but a lot of it was just more on pleasing maybe the higher ups, or having maybe not the best system, right? But a system that was just good enough, or I don't know, maybe you speak to it. Maybe I misinterpreted it.
Yeah. I mean, deliverables are obviously very important. Like the more things you can get done and released, the better it is. Because then again, the sales are happy, the traders are happy, your management is happy, their management is happy, which is the important bit. Everyone's happy. And there's a bit of conflict, because in software development, you're not really ever done. There's always improvements you can do. You can always make your code more efficient, better functioning. You can always add new features. So it's like it's a never-ending thing. And also you get to a point where you sort of finished, but it's really raw and it still probably has a bit of bugs. And it's inevitable, like no matter how sort of good you are, you still inevitably will get bugs in your code. And the primary objective was to finish your project as sort of the bare minimum. So it works, it produces what it should be, sort of get it released, done, and then focus on another project. Because that way you can release more projects, you can show more deliverables, which is obviously great for everyone. But then the flip side of that is that these kind of projects, these kind of systems, they still have bugs. They might not be tested extremely thoroughly. And usually something breaks, you know, a couple of weeks down the line. And then you have to troubleshoot them again, which is a bit time consuming. It takes everyone time. And if it's something I've built and then I go on a holiday, then somebody else needs to fix it and vice versa. So it's not an ideal situation.
Yeah. So how do you think, because I'll read the next point, because you said it's not who has the best model anymore. It's about who has the best systems, i.e. who can get the price faster, process more deals, automate everything with so increased competition. Yeah. And so, so you say it's, so would you say it's kind of maybe flawed with the approach that maybe like Goldman took, or maybe some of these other firms are taking?
I guess the idea of that next tweet, it was more about quantitative finance in general. Like the classical sense of quantitative finance is that you do a lot of pricing of complex products, for example. There is, you build mathematical models, you build these, again, both in mathematics and in sort of in code. But unfortunately, there is less and less of that these days. Right now, there are complex products, of course, but most of the models for them to price them, they've already been built. They already exist. They're already known. Like there is nothing really new. And for something new to appear, there needs to be a demand for a new complex product, which, I mean, it's not really there. The products are fairly complex as it is. There isn't much of that work, pure quantitative finance work. So what a lot of banks are doing right now is they're trying to increase the volume of their existing products instead of just trying to come up with a new product.
Right.
And that involves creating new systems which can automate this flow a little bit better, especially if we're talking about exotic products with many different features. The system needs to support all those features, like the sales, for example, because it's like an entire workflow. It's not just like price, done, trade, that's it. It's basically not just a matter of clicking a buy or sell button. But there is a lot of documentation, for example, that goes along with the product. There is a whole workflow where you have to, again, price it, book it, agree the price with the trader. You know, there's a back and forth between sales and trading about it. And then when it's finally booked, get a confirmation. So there's a lot of steps. So the more of that you can automate, the better it is, because the more trades you can do. And ultimately, you can maybe give the system to a client and then have the client price whatever deal they want, click a button, and then everything else just, you know, gets processed on the bank's end. So that's the ideal situation. And that is the focus for many, many, many desks right now. So trying to make their products as flow as they possibly can.
Yeah, that's great insight into the flow process, because I'm an order flow junkie. So, you know, it's fascinating to see how the creation of order flow, because you sit in the chair where order flow is actually created, because you guys are creating the order flow that we surf. So this is beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, you talk about exotic products, and another one of the bullet points you had in the thread was that you would argue that traders in exotic products are more quants than quants. I guess I'll ask, like, one, what would you classify as an exotic product, and what did you mean by that?
Mm-hmm, sure. So exotic products is, so we're talking about derivatives, mostly options, but instead of taking sort of plain vanilla calls and puts, you go one step higher, and then you start talking about the knock-ins, knockouts, different binary options and so on. But then you can also structure them in this note, which is like an investable, well, almost like a bond which pays a coupon, but on top of that, it has these various different features of, you know, option features where something knocks in or knocks out or gets paid before maturity. So these would be the exotic products in that sense. And for example, quants that work on these exotic products, again, since the focus is to trade as many of them as possible, and the focus is on creating systems to support all that flow and all that trading, it's very frequently that quants spend a lot of time programming and software developing, and not as much time thinking about, again, mathematical side of things, for example.
Yeah.
But traders who trade these products and who have books full of these instruments, they spend a lot of time thinking about models or how this or that parameter impacts the price or risks, or why is Vega this or that. So that's why I would argue that they understand these products much, much, much better than actually the quants who develop the models. Because the traders actually use those models on the day to day.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting, and it makes me think, like, because, you know, Sergey, like I come from like a poker gambling background, and like that was, you know, it's you think you want to go where there's maybe things maybe aren't as figured out, like you were talking about earlier. I don't know if that's a fair comparison, where you're saying like a lot of these mathematical formulas already exist. It's more just about the volume now. And so I think that makes sense. Just as like an investor or someone who's looking for an edge, you go to things where maybe they're
developing.
Right. It's developing. It's not figured out yet.
I'm thinking crypto.
Right. Well, and that's something I was going to ask you about. Like if you saw that, like in crypto, or I don't know if you dabble in the NFTs at all. So that's where you're thinking.
No, that's just an example I had in my mind when you said that. But I'm not really into crypto.
You're not into it. No. Okay. All right, you're getting me excited.
sorry for getting your hopes up.
I got a quick question. Yeah. When you said these notes, is it similar to like a convertible debenture where you'll have a bunch of different things that?
It's like a convertible bond.
It's like a convertible bond. Okay. And just quickly, how liquid are these markets for these products?
I mean, they're generally OTC.
Okay.
I mean, in terms of liquidity, like it's hard to sort of put a number on that from my side. Because again, I wasn't on the side of things where I can see
trading. Yeah. I'm just curious. Because I always wonder, you know, with all these structured products and all these very complex products, how liquid those markets are. It's interesting.
Well, the banks who sell them, they do provide two-way price. So the clients can sell and close with them. Obviously, there's counterparty risk that comes with that.
We keep hearing about notional derivatives, risk and debt, and the numbers are staggering. Can you explain a little bit of that?
In terms of why the notionals are really big, or?
Yeah. Size, you hear these hundreds of trillions of dollars.
Yeah, it's if it's somewhere in the media, then usually obviously they want to make the number as big as possible to grab people's attention.
Okay.
But in terms of derivatives, notionals sometimes can be a bit misleading because it doesn't make much sense to talk about a notional. For example, like if let's say interest rate swap. Mm-hmm. Usually, notional is just a reference value.
Okay.
On which the payments are based. So one party pays 2%, the other party pays 3%. The net is like 1%, and then 1% of a million is not really that much.
Yeah.
But you can still say it's a million, you know, the product is a 1 million size. So notionals are a little bit misleading in that sense.
Okay. Thank you.
So Sergey, so as a quant, what's your relationship like with the traders?
Good one, I hope.
Because this came. Sorry, before you go, came from. Shout out to British Steve. He wanted to know this question. He's getting into Billions right now. I don't know if you've seen the show Billions, and so
I've heard of it. Never
yeah. So there's some tension sometimes between the quants and the traders. So yeah, we want to hear from real life. Well, what's it like?
Well, first of all, it's been really good. Like. Very frequently we work on like similar projects. So traders, they explain to us like what exactly they want to see or what numbers they want to see or what kind of things they want to, you know, back test or check or whatever. So far, like it's been really good working with them. I think we never had problems sort of, you know, it was more difficult working with quants and other teams than with traders.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I'd probably say that. Traders have been quite approachable in that sense, and they're obviously willing to help. And for a reason, because they obviously know that we are working to help them.
Exactly.
So there's a mutual benefit there. In general, the relationship is that, especially, and that again, that depends on different desks. So it depends what kind of desk you're on. Because some desks, if it's like equity trading, Delta One, the products isn't that complex. So the reliance on quants is not that significant. Whereas if you look something like structured products or even simple plain vanilla options, the risks are more difficult to calculate. Like you cannot easily calculate the risks or exposures of your big options book in your head. Like you really have to have some systems that, you know, completely break down your P&L in terms of delta, gamma, whatever. And that's where you need quants. That's where you need people to, and not just quants, obviously software developers who will build these systems, who will give traders the visibility in terms of what their risks are, what their P&L is, and so on. Some scenario analysis maybe. So that's where quants come in. That's pretty much it.
Okay. And is there any difference between a sell side quant and a buy side quant?
Of course.
Yeah. I'm gonna be curious there.
So sell side quant, again, it's a person working in banks. Buy side quant, it's mostly hedge funds and all kinds of different funds. And obviously, since the companies, they have different priorities, they have different businesses, the job itself varies a lot. Sell side quants, obviously, they help, first of all, they help traders. They calculate the risks, they calculate the P&L. They help trading manage their books correctly. So that's sort of the main responsibility of the sell side quant. And since traders are in the business of sort of making markets, the focus is to find an edge within that. So to be able to find an edge to try to make more deals, try to increase volume, and try to make the hedging process as easy, as cheap as it can possibly be. Buy side of things, obviously they are in the sort of capital allocation business. So they're trying to find an edge within markets. They're trying to invest in better, better deals, better products, better strategies. So in there you're working more on, again, backtesting things, essentially researching. So that's the area where like statistics, probability, that comes really handy. So, yeah.
Okay. Now do a lot, you know, obviously you would know better than me. That's why I'm asking. I just hear rumors and stuff, but they say like a lot of sell side quants go to work for buy side, or I don't know if the buy side recruits from sell side. Is that true? Is there truth to that?
Yes. Yeah. I'd say there's a bit of truth in that. It's, at least in my experience, I found, and from talking to other people, I found that it's very difficult to get into a hedge fund as a quant sort of straight out, fresh out of uni. I mean, obviously there are some hedge funds that do that, but usually after doing a couple of years on the sell side, there's much more you can offer to hedge funds, right? You can say that you've worked on these things, you know the markets well, you have some experience, and obviously hedge funds like that much better. Quite many of my ex-colleagues have moved into hedge funds after that. Okay. So it's a common path.
Yeah,
I'd say.
Okay.
Either that or move into trading.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Excellent. What you know, because most of our listeners are retail traders, if I probably mean all of them. What unique perspective do you think you have working in the industry that would be beneficial to a retail trader?
Good question. I'd probably say that the biggest one, I am struggling to answer this a bit, because
that's all right. We could come back to it.
I'm not sure there's a significant, well, I mean,
yeah,
it really depends where you are. Like, obviously if you're working as an institutional trader, then you know the markets, you know how things move. You know, sort of the flow, the customers, the business, that side of things. And also once you move into retail trading, then you can take that information and, you know, use it to your advantage, because, you know, again, you know the demand, you know how to analyze. Yeah. I think in my opinion, the biggest advantage from working for an institution is the experience, because you work with people, with other traders, with other quants, and it's much, much, much easier to learn. Many, many things that people learn on the desk, they're not written in books, unfortunately. Yeah. And it's not something that you can read or learn by reading. Like, it's an experience. So I guess that's the main thing, the main benefit from working in an institution. On my side, but again, that's taking the trading side of things. On the quant side of things, it's slightly different, because you don't get as much exposure to the trading desk and to the strategies as you do if you're a trader. You really have to sort of push yourself and really show more initiative to actually speak with traders and ask them to explain various things than you would have to do if you actually were part of the team.
So it's
that exposure is a bit limited if you're a quant.
Okay, makes sense. Now, how's your interest been in through your career and like till now with actual trading yourself? Have you always traded your own account? Was that something you're allowed to do?
So I really wanted to, like, two periods of my career, I really wanted to move into trading. So it was certainly something that's been on my mind. And despite all my efforts, I've never actually managed to make the break. I was very close multiple times, but in the end still didn't make it. So that's that. And then all the trading I do is from my personal accounts. Luckily, Goldman was very flexible in terms of things you can trade out of personal. Obviously, there's a lot of compliance, so it's still very limited. But they had a list of, for example, stocks, or sorry, not stocks, single stocks out of the question, a list of products like indices, like S&P 500, for example, that you can trade without asking for compliance to approval. Yeah. Which is really great. So you can run a few limited strategies based on that, which is what I did.
Okay.
Right now it's a bit more limited. Like I have stopped any of my strategies right now because since I quit, currently I'm trying to this YouTube and Twitter thing, and my family and I were basically living off our savings at the moment. And while I do that, I don't want to take any extra risk coming from the market exposure. So I've wrapped up all my option strategies for now, which is quite ironic because after having quit the full-time job, I'm free to trade whatever I want.
Exactly.
You
don't have seven compliance officers to.
Yes, exactly. So whatever strategy, whatever ETF, just go for it. And you want to buy GME, just to do it.
Well, it sounds like the prudent thing that you're doing though right now.
It is.
Definitely. I cannot wait to get back into it. So once I have some clarity in terms of where I'm going with this YouTube and Twitter, I cannot wait to get back to this.
Excellent. Is there any, we don't got to dive into like the nitty gritty of it, but any overview on the type of strategies that you like to implement and what markets you would trade?
Yeah, of course. So mostly options. So in terms of single names, I'm not that big of a fan of like scanning a lot of different stocks and then, doing some factor analysis. Like it's fun, but I always found it a bit complicated to do because then you have to get the fundamental data, the price to book ratios and so on, and then it wasn't, at least to me, as exciting as doing some back testing on option strategies. And one of the things I could trade was the S&P 500, and my main strategies revolved around selling volatility on S&P 500. So I have a few dynamic strategies related to again short volatility and then how you manage that in different market scenarios. So that was my main thing.
Okay. All right. Excellent.
Apart from that, also I wanted to, I briefly traded a few relative value strategies where you can again look at the volatility of S&P index and then the Euro stocks, for example, and if there is some dislocation between the two, then you can take advantage of that.
All right. Excellent. Yeah, I'm undergoing. I just trade equities at the moment, but I'm undergoing learning options. It's exciting. I'm like, man, I should have done this earlier. I think, but
I knew you would take to that like a fish to water.
I see a lot of correlations to with the person I'm learning from. He's kind of like using a lot of corollaries to bet sports betting, which I'm familiar with, and so it makes a lot of sense. At least from that angle, I'm excited diving into it.
Yeah, it's certainly very interesting, very risky, but quite interesting.
Yeah. There's a lot of different pieces that go into it. Or at least it seems like that at first. I don't know if it's just because I'm new to it, but it seems just a little bit more depth, maybe a little bit more depth to it, maybe is the word.
Yeah. Once you get your head around it, like it becomes quite simple. Like it's very logical.
Yeah. Perfect.
Like, I think it's, for me at least, I think it's much more difficult to trace the relationship in terms of like macroeconomic factors of how, I don't know, supply chain constraints have an impact on whatever. Like I think in that relationship is much more difficult. With options, it's very clear, it's very logical, like you can think through the impacts,
right? Which is very appealing to me, which is very appealing because like you said, like a lot of times trying to connect all the moving pieces is perhaps impossible, I guess, right? Like it's like no one can really predict the market. But your thread you had on the JP Morgan options trade made it to zero hedge on Twitter. That's a big accomplishment, man. Congrats, by the way.
thank you. That was a big surprise.
Yeah, that was really cool. It was titled the big trade under the surface. I know it was a relatively long thread, but do you think maybe you could summarize it for the listeners? And if you guys are curious, please go to his Twitter. He'll mention that at the end of the podcast. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. The trade is quite interesting because, first of all, because of the size, and at least to me, it's interesting because it's visible. Like it's not an OTC trade. Like anyone can go and check out the open interest on these options, and see that trade. Like it's not hidden, which I think is very incredible. The other thing is that it's an options trade, which means that there are certain implications resulting from the trade. Like there are certain things that you can derive based on that trade alone. This trade, of course, it's not the only force in the market. Market is a sort of complicated thing. So none of the conclusions that come from this trade are guaranteed. It's just that you can come up with a certain forces that result from this trade. But these forces, again, they have to be taken into context with other market forces. And in different times, different forces can dominate. So unfortunately, it's not an exact science, but there are certainly very interesting implications from this.
Yeah. The okay, so I guess the follow-up question, this is one of the listener questions too. They so the JP Morgan collar trade, doesn't every major financial institution do this, or is this something similar or something similar to protect clients? And if not, that's the first part of the question. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, many funds do that, many investors do that in sort of different shapes or forms. Because the strategy, if you break it down, it's a quite simple strategy. And it consists of, first of all, selling a call, which is a covered call is a very popular strategy, the call overwriting. Again, many funds do that. Many pension funds do that. So that's one side of the strategy. And the other one is long put, which is basically buying protection. Of course, they do a put spread instead of just a naked put. But either way, that's basically buying protection from the market.
Yeah,
and that's again, that's something that's a lot of the whole market is doing. Everyone wants protection. Everyone needs protection. People are buying puts, but then the protection itself is very expensive. So one way you can make it a bit cheaper is to sell some of the upside. Especially if you think that the upside is limited, maybe you can cap it.
Yeah. It's, you sacrifice some of the upside. So what's the danger of this trade here for, I guess, like the broader implications of the market? Is there anything that's, that could go wrong here?
I wouldn't specifically say it as a danger, because so far the forces that come from this trade, or the flows that are a result of this trade, they're more stabilizing for the market than volatile.
Okay.
So for instance, if we look at the call option, the JP Morgan is short the call option. The dealers are long the call option, which means that they have to, in order to delta hedge, they have to buy into the weakness and sell on strength, which basically just means that they stabilize the market a bit. If the market rallies, they sell. If the market falls, they buy it back. So these falls, they work against what the market is doing.
Oh, okay.
So that's, that reduces the volatility.
In the old days, that'd be called running a box. I used to do it in stocks, it's stock trading all the time, especially when I need to stabilize a market. I just box it up, put a million on the bid, million on the offer, and bang around between the two. Yeah.
Nice. So the delta hedging is resulting in these flows as well.
Cool. Yeah.
Okay. So
that's the call side. The interesting bit is that there is also the put side, which is, it works slightly in a different way. Because if you look just at the, I don't want to make it a bit more complex, but if you look at the gamma, which is the changes in delta with respect to the underlying price, then gamma is destabilizing for the put. So that it forces the dealers to sell if the market is falling and buy when the market rises. But there's a big but. And that but is that when the market falls, volatility rises and gamma becomes less important. Hence the fact that the dealers need to, the fact that they add to volatility because of this gamma becomes less important because the volatility is high. And that's where other forces come into play, specifically VANA, which I'm happy to explain as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Please.
So in short, it also acts as a stabilizer for the market. So again, a bit of disclaimer. These forces, they're still going against whatever is currently happening in the market. Like even if dealers, for example, are forced to buy 5 billion of S&P because of the delta hedging, it does not mean that the market cannot fall 1-5%. Like if there's some big macroeconomic implications or fundamental reasons, then it really doesn't matter what the option market makers are doing, because the market is going to do its own thing anyway.
Order flow.
For example, like in end of February 2020, March 2020, like if there was a big shock to the market, gamma, VANA, it becomes completely irrelevant. The market is selling off because, you know, the economy is shutting down. The whole world is shutting down. It doesn't matter what VANA is.
That's bid off.
Yes. Yeah.
Bid off. Everything changes when it's bid off, baby.
Yeah. But when things are more or less relatively quiet right now, these forces can have a bit more meaningful impact. And the deal with puts, which I find it quite fascinating, is that when the market falls, volatility rises. Generally, the market is long puts, and especially right now when this queue is very steep. So everyone's loaded up on puts, everyone's uncertain. They're uncertain about Fed tapering and supply chain issues in China, economy going slower. So a lot of things going on. Everyone's really concerned. People bought puts. If for whatever reason the market goes down, the dealers who are short these puts, again, they need to delta hedge. If these puts become in the money and the market went down, usually volatility rises. Because of the rise of volatility, the deltas will, let me get it right. The deltas will become lower for these already in the money, newly in the money puts. And as a result, the dealers will need to buy back some of their hedges. So this usually means that we don't necessarily, we shouldn't see big, big market crashes, but we should see something more of a corrections where the index goes down and then it, because of this really, really big delta hedging flows, it snaps back up quite rapidly. And again, we've seen that in March 2020, we've seen that in the end of 2018, and then a big massive rally, like there was a sell-off in December 2018, and then followed by a big massive rally in January 2019. So you do see these kind of dynamics, which can be explained by this VANA, VANA dynamics, VANA flows.
Yeah. No, excellent. I appreciate you sharing that. And I think that's why people are, your Twitter page, your YouTube page, you're gaining a lot of traction. Cause this type of information is valuable. I mean, and no one else really, and I saw someone was tweeting at you too, like someone in the industry, he was saying to have like it took him years to, or like even when he was working on the desk, no one wanted to tell him these things. And so like this type of information is very valuable for us.
And now, I completely agree. And it's incredible how this information is now on Twitter. Like, again, it's not like I haven't come up with this myself, obviously. I think in this case with this Twitter thread, I'm sort of standing on the shoulders of giants. I'm building on what other people have already tweeted, what they already showed and shared. And it's incredible how Twitter is full of these very useful, incredibly interesting threads and people sharing and discussing these things. It's incredible to sort of be part of that as well.
Yeah, it is. No. I know. Twitter can be, or anywhere online can be toxic at times. But Twitter is also a really great resource. You following the right people, connecting with people. It's awesome.
The feedback loops on the internet are quite strong. If you're wrong, you will know straight away.
Indeed. All right. So we got some listener questions here as well. I think some of them I've touched on already. I guess the first one's here about Gamma. I'm hearing a lot about GEX, gamma exposure. What is this in layman's terms and how much does it typically move markets?
Mm-hmm. So that's what we briefly touched on that. Mm-hmm. So gamma is basically when, it's a fancy way of saying how much your delta will change as the underlying index moves around. Because the changes in delta is what triggers market makers and dealers to re-hedge their books. So if the delta doesn't change, then there is no flows coming from the dealers and they don't move the market or they don't influence the markets. Gamma is sort of a big one because it impacts the delta quite a lot, especially if we are in relatively low vol environment, if the options are short dated and there is a big open interest on certain strikes. And if we are somewhere close to those strikes as well. So in that sense, gamma will change the delta. And if delta changes, then dealers will need to buy or sell the market. Now, the interesting thing about that is that you can calculate for any given option, you can calculate both the gamma and the delta. And if you can calculate those and you know the open interest, you can calculate how much exposure results from that single option. And what's even more interesting is, again, based on a few assumptions, but if you know what's the exposure of the dealers, if you know how much the dealers are short or long a certain option, you can then say they're short or long gamma. And usually, for example, with this JP Morgan trade, if we take a look at this call option, which the JP Morgan has sold, the dealers are long. This means that the dealers are essentially long gamma, which means that if the market falls, they have to buy it. If the market rises, they'll sell it. So they're acting like they're reducing volatility, basically. So that's what long gamma means in this case.
Okay, awesome. All right, next one we got here. How important is it for retail options traders to understand the complex math behind the concepts such as price modeling, IG Black Souls, second order Greeks, etc.?
It's obviously an interesting question. in other words, should I bother going into this Black Souls? Is it worth it? It's a lot of maths and complicated, and I don't feel like it. I mean, like many other things, it certainly helps. Like I cannot say that it's absolutely vital, because if you have sort of the intuition how things work, like how implied volatility changes the price, how different dynamics impact the option price, because as a trader, as an options trader, that's like one of the absolute must things you have to have a feel for. If market falls like 2%, what's your delta impact? What's your vega impact? What's your P&L impact? So you need to be able to somewhat decompose these things. Knowing the Black-Scholes formulas and the reasoning behind them helps. It's not necessary. Again, you can sort of, there are many tools that will help you with that. Like, you don't have to really go into math details yourself and program a Black-Scholes pricer. It's not necessary. But again, if you have some spare minutes, if it's a free weekend and there isn't much else to do and it's raining outside, it'll certainly help with understanding.
Yeah, all right, makes sense. All right, so back to the whole GEX thing, how options influence the entire markets. Is this a relatively new phenomenon, or has it nearly always been present, but not many people knew about it? Is it becoming more increasingly more influential in markets, and does it provide any future systematic risk to the markets?
So in terms of the recency, and again, from the people that they have been in the markets for a long time, obviously I found out about this fairly recently. Like, so it's I've been working with options for a long time, but again, thinking about gamma or VANA in that sense has been something recent because of the very big increase in the options volume lately. Mm-hmm. Like, again, options have been becoming, like, the dynamics, all of that has been the same. Like, nothing has changed about gamma or VANA. Like, that's how, what options are. That's how they work anyway. And that's how they worked last decade, two decades ago, and so on. It's just that over time, over the last 10 years, the volumes have been increasing year over year over year over year. More people start trading options. And I still find it really fascinating how I can trade options. So people can trade options from their phone. I mean, it's one thing where you can trade stocks, but it's another thing where you can now trade these more or less complex products where you need to, have a scenario chart and look at all the different things. And you can do it from your phone. Like, it's incredible. And obviously, the options volume have been increasing. And because of that, the hedging flows from these options volumes are having much more impact than they used to have before. And hence, people noticed that. They started talking about it a bit more. And it's really gained traction over the last couple of years. There are many people, again, on Twitter as well, who provide services into this, like they provide visibility into how much gamma is there in the market, how much vega. So that thing is more recent because of the size of the options market right now.
No, that's really, it is interesting. All right, next question. What's the ideal time frame for options expiry that can be invested in if you're day trading versus taking 2 to 3 day swing trades?
Well, first of all, with options, I mean, regardless of what your trading strategy is, the most liquidity the options have are on the short end of the curve. So again, if you're looking at 2 years out for S&P, even for S&P, which is a very liquid market, like, it's extremely difficult to get a fill on the near the mid price, because the options are very, like, especially if you're doing some complex, like, four leg strategy, it becomes extremely difficult because it's liquid. I mean, and for many other reasons as well. Like, even if you want to just, buy a put and protect your portfolio over the next 2 years, well, if the index rallies over the next 2 years, your put is going to be extremely out of the money, and it's not going to provide you with much protection. So that's why most of the liquidity, most of the action is happening on, near term, sort of all the way to 3-4 months options. So I think there was a second part of the question in terms of if you're day trading or if...
2 to 3 day swing trade. Yeah.
I mean, it really depends on your strategy, I'd say. But again, if you're swing trading or day trading, it's very likely doing that with options where there's a lot of liquidity, which means that usually it's the front months, the second months. It's, you're not going to day trade or swing trade or go in and out with, you know, 2-year options.
Yeah. All right. This next question would be as to how the dealer or market makers look at huge volume and open interest in December 17th AM SPX call and puts, and sooner or later it will be unwound.
So the question is how much the dealers look into the open interest.
Yes. Yes. At a huge volume and open interest. Yeah.
So, the dealers, if it depends sort of how much of that is the dealer's exposure.
Sure.
In the sense that, for example, if we're looking at put options, usually the dealers are short put options because people buy them for protection. So it's fair to say that that open interest is probably the dealers being, having sold those put options.
Okay.
If the open interest is significant, so for example, right now, for November, I think last time I checked, there was about 20,000 more contracts for puts than for calls on the 4,000 SPX strike. Those need to be delta hedged. So the implications are that there is a lot of gamma sitting on that strike. And if we get close to that, then you will need to think, and if the volatility is sort of relatively, if it doesn't spike, if we fall to 4K, they need to sort of, you can measure how much gamma is there, how much delta will change, and then you can check how much what the dealers will trade based on that.
Mm-hmm. All right, next question. Can you explain the trade execution process at Goldman Sachs from the portfolio manager or firm's idea for a trade to how it gets assigned to you to create an algorithm and then execution of such algorithm?
So it's something a bit different. It's certainly not something that my desk was doing. So I'm not really sure, like in terms of, it really depends because the trade ideas or systematic trade ideas, they come from different people. I mean, most of that it's internal Goldman's research, internal banks research. Mm-hmm. And then again, if there's demand, obviously they speak to clients. If there's demand for a certain trade idea, then they will implement it and they will sort of make it live and so on. But it's a slightly different desk that was doing that. So I'm not really sure exactly on the process of trade idea origination and then to the delivery.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Does every portfolio team have an assigned analyst like yourself, or is that how it works there? Or
it's usually per desks. So
the
big trading floor, they're split into different, again, asset classes. And then within the asset class, you can have different sort of smaller pockets of expertise.
Got it.
And yeah, usually there's every desk has a certain number of quants that support that desk.
Cool.
And the size of that, again, depends on the team, depends on the desk, depends on on the cost cutting pressures of the management. So it's,
All right, but
usually I mean from anywhere from 2 to 5 quants.
All right. And this last question here is percentage. It's asking, I guess it would be obviously like an estimate, but at big investment bank firms like Goldman Sachs, what percent are being executed via like algorithms or high frequency trading versus the trader executing the trade himself?
Again, that completely depends on the product. Obviously, if you're talking about Delta One stocks, futures, then it's much, much easier to do the algorithm or do it algorithmically. Whereas again, if it's something a bit more complex, a lot of stuff in fixed income, for example, they tend to be a bit more manual. Exotic products, they're manual as well. Where again, the trading, the sales structure, the deal, and then, you know, it's booked and the trader has to do all the other hedging activities. It's increasingly more, like as we discussed at the beginning, the desks try to automate as much as possible as they can. But then again, that completely depends on the complexity of the product they're working with.
Yeah. All right. And this, the last listener question, and then I got one too, because you got me thinking about something. Cause it was, I guess it kind of pertained to one of your videos, which I didn't watch. I didn't get to this one, but you had one talking about GameStop. and that that whole situation. And I want to ask you a little bit about it. But this last question is, large banking firms, do they care about or think about retail traders and where they might be parking themselves in trades?
I think right now it's becoming more and more increasingly important.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, that's what I want to ask. So, like, is that something that's like maybe it's a new thing now? Maybe we've seen what happened with GameStop and stuff, and maybe you could just speak to that in like the video or just a little bit. Mm-hmm. What your thoughts were on that?
It's certainly something that's a recent trend. Like again, when I started working, like that was like back in 2017. Retail trader was not considered to be this very important person or very important, market player. I think the GameStop story has completely shown the power of the retail trading because they can cooperate together and move the markets that way.
Yeah.
Because everyone individually is not a big person, right? It's not a big sort of, there's not enough gunpowder to really make an impact.
Yeah.
But again, if everybody piles in on the same thing, then it's inevitably will move the market. And right now, the technology with Robinhood, which is also a relatively recent broker, but with people doing that and buying their stocks again on their phones, it's much more volume is now coming from retail. And people want to be part of that. People want to participate in the markets as well. And hence, the banks also have to consider that flow as part of their analysis.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially if there are painful lessons of not considering this flow as part of your analysis.
Very true.
It's crazy. These kids are like sitting on the toilet, like going long AMC, like right off their phone. You know what I mean?
Like pretty much.
I've moved blocks from the same position, so can't hate.
It's incredible that you can do that. Again, you can sit on your toilet and trade the markets real time. It's fascinating,
isn't it? It's just fascinating.
Yeah, no, it's funny because I think on the you're talking about how maybe the retail traders need to be like, or at least like the group need to be paid attention to now. It's like, think about like in your days, JJ, like that was like that's who you guys feasted on.
It was like lunch.
Yeah.
Right. But I mean, that's it's, I'm really happy that retail, as long, people are still going to lose money, but at least people have the best shot they have now. They have access to education. They have access to technology, right? Back in the days, you'd have to call your broker, put in a trade. He calls me. I do the trade. I give him the fill. Then it goes back to the broker. You're waiting for the fill. By the time the market's moved $2 and you get slipped at least 80 cents, right? And then, I got to pay the market maker. So everyone's feeding off of the guy, right? This way it's, and now commissionless trades. My God, back in the day, I mean, nobody would do business for less than a kosher eighth. That was before I started. And I started and then it was a 32nd, but it's great though. I love to see it because I love the liquidity, liquidity
is incredible,
right? It's just amazing. I mean, you have stocks that are no-name stocks trading $5 billion worth of dollar volume every day. They're like Olympic sized swimming pools of liquidity out there and under $5 stock. It's just insane, And the order flow now, thanks to algorithms, because a lot of old traders don't like quants and algorithms. And I am the opposite. I love you guys. I don't know what the hell you do, but it makes for a beautiful orderly market. And my levels work to the penny. And, the stuff stops right on a penny because, algos, they don't get emotional. They stop where they're supposed to, and it's just amazing. And I'm sure the brokerage firms are happier and happier because, you don't have to bail an algo out of jail at 3 a.m. like a regular desk trader. And, it's a lot cheaper, like the legal fees are less, and they don't have to go to rehab. I'm all for it. Bring it on. I love the technology.
Yeah, it's certainly pretty, pretty incredible. I still like, again, back in university, my bank was offering share dealing services. And I remember asking them, like, so how much does it cost? And the commission was £10, £10.
Yeah.
For one trade. And obviously, when you're a student, that's like your 2 weeks worth of living expenses. you're not going to do much trading with that.
My ticket charge was $25. I wouldn't do it. Yeah, I wouldn't get out of bed for less than 4% of the dollar volume of the trade.
Now you don't have to, JJ.
I know.
Right off your phone, out of bed.
Out of bed, right? Yeah, trading in bed.
And for free as well, which is again, yeah, very
amazing. Incredible. Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. What else? I had something else. Oh, yeah. So, Sergey, I guess last thing, I'll let you get going. When you're working at Goldman, what was there any conversations, whether it was, you know, between you and maybe higher ups or you and just other, you know, coworkers on crypto, any conversations around that?
Really sorry. I don't have a good, exciting answer for that. Pretty much no. I mean, between colleagues. Yeah. I mean, there was, there were a few who were like doing crypto on their own sort of personal account based, you know, they had an interest in Bitcoin, for example. Mm-hmm. So obviously you can ask them and bounce a few questions, you know, they help you explain and help you understand what's going on with crypto and how it works. But I mean, you can have the same conversations with anyone sort of from outside of Goldman. Like there was not anything related to Goldman's initiative around Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any other crypto for that matter.
Yeah, I was just curious kind of maybe if there was like a, I don't know, you know, stigma or like a perception, you know, within Goldman.
Not really.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. All right, neat, cool. All right. And I guess with that, that'll conclude today's episode of Confessions of a Market Maker. If you guys enjoyed today's episode, please rate and review it for us. If you'd like to join a fun professional group of traders, you can join JJ and I at microefutures.com. Sergey, tell the listeners where they can find you and anything else you'd like them to know.
thank you very much for watching the listening to the podcast. I am available on YouTube and Twitter, so if you have any questions, obviously you can get in touch. There is an email on the YouTube account, and my DMs and Twitter are open as well. So it might take me a couple of days to get back to you, but I really hope I can answer your questions, so feel free to reach out.
Yeah, yeah. Go follow his stuff. It's real informative, very detailed. JJ, parting words.
Thank you so much for joining us and shedding some light onto the other side of things and into the new world of trading. Really, really appreciate it. And yeah, definitely follow this gentleman, you know, and look at this stuff. I always bug the Gamma guys, you know, and it's but it's really great to have you on here to explain it. And make it, you know, it's like the guy said, Jeremy Irons said in the movie, explain it to me like I'm a golden retriever, right? And it was great. It's really, really good. It's because it's nice being able to put these pictures together that, you know, you hear a lot of esoteric talk and things like that. It's nice when somebody comes along and actually explains it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure being here. Thank you very much.
All right. Excellent. And I second what JJ said. Appreciate you, Sergey. Thank you so much. So, for Sergey, I'm Paulie Walnuts. He's the gorilla of House Street. You stop, so.